Now, this is from the Goldie souvenir. See, Ramana's wondrous grace, that's the last one. We received the following article very late in August 1946, and the covering letter, the, quote, self-styled devotee, unquote, vouches for the truth of his writing. To save himself from some embarrassment, he has tried to hide himself behind an assumed title. We know him well, but we do not want to embarrass him either. And we never figured out who the person is. Even Captain Narayan was figuring out who wrote this article. Well, maybe when we read it this time, we'll figure it out. This much, however, we must say. He is one of the contributors to this souvenir, and his article stands along with those of other devotees in the previous pages of this volume.
Ah,
so okay. His name is here, somewhere, okay. Already contributed. Really, the writer of Sri Ramana's Wondrous Grace is a true devotee of Sri Bhagavan. Below is his letter, and then comes his article, which we are sure will deeply interest the reader, who is the final judge for deciding things for himself. I guess so, right? The editor wrote that. Dear sir, I'm sending you here with an article. If it meets with your approval, it may be included in the souvenir volume. As I have described here some experiences which should not be divulged to anybody else, I cannot publish my name. Kindly excuse me for this. I declare that the statements made are all true, to my knowledge. Whether you publish it or not, I request you kindly place this article before Sri Bhagavan, so that he may remember me and take thought of me. Note, Sri Bhagavan is expected to identify the me without the writer revealing it himself. According to the editor here. You are sincerely a self-styled devotee. It was on a cold afternoon of December that I found myself boarding the Madras mail with a view to visit Sri Ramanashrama. For a couple of years previous to this, the intention of going on a pilgrimage to Sri Ramanashrama had been lurking in my mind now and then. A few months back, a strong urge came, and I made all arrangements for starting for the ashram. Suddenly, the news came that the East Coast was being bombed by the Japanese. Now, we know this date exactly, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is it? 1944?
Yeah,
Assam.
And
Pearl Harbor, right?
Madras. They did drop some bombs outside the port of Madras. There were some boats out there.
Yeah.
And Japanese did.
But
they didn't, not in the mainland.
No.
But outside. And there's probably the date we can look it up.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Madras. Not the
Pearl
Harbor.
No.
Madras, Pearl Harbor.
The Madras Harbor.
Yeah.
I was dissuaded from going there at that time. A sense of frustration came over me, and the desire to go there sank within, leaving a vague resolve to visit the ashram in December. December came. The expectation again floated in my mind, but there was no agitation in it, as previous frustrations had made the mind somewhat resigned. However, a day was fixed, and all arrangements were made for my departure. I was undecided and left everything to circumstances. And circumstances so molded themselves that I found myself boarding the train for Madras on the next day. The journey was uneventful, though there was the usual wartime congestion in the trains. I was comfortably seated and also found sleeping accommodation at night. On the afternoon of the second day of my journey, I picked up a companion. So he's coming from a ways off. He must have been Andhra Pradesh.
From Madras.
No, but he took the Madras mail eventually. coming from maybe Andhra Pradesh.
Yes, I did some intelligence here. You're exactly right.
Oh.
It's from Kakinada.
Oh, you Googled it?
I'm looking at it. It's fascinating history. 1943 October.
And,
yeah, it's happened. I think there were a couple places near Madras, one near Kakinada, and one near Colombo.
Oh,
so
and what
much
was
has
the
happened.
Date?
Pardon me?
What was the date? I mean, what was the year?
1943.
What month?
October.
So in December he went after that.
Yeah.
So it was 42 December.
So we're narrowing.
We're closing in on him.
Yeah.
Okay.
This Kakinada was where their British treasury was.
I know that.
Yeah.
That's why they...
There's a chair right there and I have to go attack him.
Okay. The second day of the journey, I picked up a companion. Mm. He expressed his intention to visit Ramanashram to pay his respects to Maharshi, and so we traveled together. We reached Madras on the afternoon of the third day. On inquiry, we were informed that a train would be just leaving the Egmore station for Vilupuram, from where we would have to change for Tiruvannamalai, our destination. It was about midnight when we alighted at Vilupuram. After some time, the train came. It was not crowded at all, and we too occupied one small compartment in it. Ever since I came to know of Maharshi, the thought of Arunachala had always been in my mind, but it did not give rise to any strong emotion up till now. Only the mind was in a gloomy mood. When we were a few stations from Tiruvannamalai, the thought of a rebuff at the ashram became very strong and roused a correspondingly strong emotion in me. As I was unobserved, my one companion being fast asleep, and there being nobody else in the compartment, I gave free vent to my emotion. Footnote. I have used the first person only as a matter of convention. As a matter of fact, this and the other states of mind and body described later as experienced by me were simply produced in me, and I had no hand in their production. I tried to reproduce these states afterwards but could not do so. After some time it spent itself and the mind became resigned. The train now stopped, so he was like emotionally overwhelmed, thinking he'd have a rebuff. Nobody would notice him, Bhagavan wasn't paying attention to him, and
the whole trip wasted.
So. I aroused my companion, who was still sleeping, and we set our feet on the sacred soil of Tiruvannamalai. It was already dawn, and we came out of the station. The hill of Arunachala now caught our eyes. Silent and majestic, it stood there, as if immersed in deep meditation. We saluted the Jyotir Lingam and drove direct to the ashram. It happened to be the annual birthday of Maharshi. Bhaktas were preparing to celebrate the day on a large scale. Huge preparations were being made for feeding a few thousand people, and a big pandal was erected for the purpose. At the farther end of the first quadrangle, a small enclosure was erected, and a seat was arranged there for Maharshi, leaving a small space in front of the enclosure for the passage of pilgrims. The whole of the quadrangle and the adjoining veranda were crowded with visitors. Maharshi took his seat within the enclosure. Pilgrims came in a line, prostrated themselves before him, paid their respects, and then passed out of the quadrangle. A continuous stream of people passed in this way for a couple of hours. I was all along anxious to catch his eye, but could not do so. When the crowd became thinner, I got up, walked up to the enclosure, and took my stand just outside it, toward the right of Maharshi. With folded hands and tearful eyes, I stood there, eagerly expecting to catch his eyes. though some people were asked to pass on to make room for others, I was fortunately not disturbed. I continued standing there, allowing ample room for the free passage of other pilgrims who still continued to pass on. I waited and waited. Mixed emotions pulsated through the body, and tears flowed down the cheeks. I know not why. My whole being was irresistibly being drawn towards him. At last, he was turning his head towards his right, that is, in my direction. Expectation rose high, but alas, his gaze passed on without falling on me. Frustration further intensified my sense of helplessness. My whole being poured forth silent entreaty and convulsive sobs. Ah, now immediately after, I seemed to obtain a side glance from his eyes, while a sweet smile beamed on his face. A peculiar sensation passed through my body, and my whole being seemed to be churned. A minute later, I passed out of the quadrangle. The next morning, I got up early, and after finishing my bath, attended the morning prayers in the hall. Well-versed Brahmins recited Vedic hymns. Some slokas offering homage to Maharshi were also recited. All these were done as routine work every morning and evening. After the prayers are over, all assembled in the dining hall and, and take their breakfast with Maharshi. Maharshi also takes the two principal meals along with all the guests. The same food as is served to Maharshi is also served to one and all present. And he does not allow any discrimination in this matter. I was eager to put my case before Maharshi and try to find out somebody who would introduce me to him and speak to him on my behalf. I approached some inmates of the ashram, but every one of them told me that no introduction or intermediary was necessary here. Anyone could personally approach Maharshi and speak to him directly, but I could not muster sufficient courage to speak to him, or rather, I did not know what to speak to him. Thus, the second day also passed away without my being able to make any contact with him. I had only a few days at my disposal, and 2 days had already gone. With this journey, so much trouble and such a cost, would all these be for nothing? These thoughts overwhelmed me and goaded me to offer most earnest prayers. The next morning, I entreated another inmate of the ashram to put my case before Maharshi. He looked at me for a moment and then advised me to write down whatever I intended to say on a piece of paper and to place it before Sri Bhagavan. He also gave me a piece of paper. Write down. What should I write down? But I was not in a thinking mood then. I wrote down whatever came to my mind. He very kindly took the piece of paper, went to the hall, followed by me, and placed the paper before Maharshi, speaking something to him in Tamil. Maharshi read it and smiled. And smiling, he turned toward me. I was sitting there, with folded hands and eyes filled with tears. As he looked at me, I was overwhelmed, and a violent emotion convulsed my body, which set Maharshi laughing. He laughed merrily for some time, and then silently folded the paper and left it on the bookshelf, which stood nearby. He did not speak to me, nor did he seem to pay any further attention to me. The mind cannot remain in a tense state for long. Sheer exhaustion calms it down. My mind calmed down after some time. The bell rang, summoning us to dinner, and we followed Maharshi to the dining hall. I had placed my case before Maharshi. He did not even speak to me. Rather, he laughed at me. There was nothing more to be done. I must return home and be a laughingstock also to my friends and relatives. What could be done? He could not be forced to bestow grace. With these thoughts, the mind became resigned. After the night meal, they used to spend half an hour in meditation in the hall in Maharshi's presence. Mechanically, I followed them and sat with them in the hall. A few minutes passed. Then suddenly I felt a pleasant coolness inundating me. It seemed to emanate from the very bones, cooling the whole being. Is this the spiritual fragrance spoken of as emanating from Maharshi? Whatever it might be, I had no doubt that it came from Maharshi and at his will. This was the night of the third day of my visit. And the next day, while sitting before Maharshi, I experienced a sudden pull in the region of the heart. I was astonished, and as I sought to observe it, it passed away. Nothing like the experience of the previous night was repeated. The remainder of the day passed in keen expectation, but nothing happened. Even during the meditation period after the night meal, perhaps expectation obstructed its manifestation. The next morning, that is, on the fifth day of my stay at the ashram, news came of further heavy bombing of the eastern coastline by the Japanese. And I was naturally, and I naturally became anxious for my family. Moreover, as I did not experience anything unusual during the meditation periods of the previous night and of that morning, I thought that I had obtained what I deserved and that nothing more would be gained by a further stay at the ashram. So I decided to return home. In the afternoon, I wrote out my intention to go home on a piece of paper and placed it before Maharshi. He read it, silently, folded the paper, and left it on the shelf. He spoke nothing and did not even look at me. Another rebuff. I made preparations for my departure, picked up my small belongings, and after taking my evening meal, requested an inmate of the ashram to kindly get a carriage for me. But I was told that no carriage would be available at that hour, that I should have informed him earlier, so that one might have been fetched from the town. I was thus compelled to stay at the ashram for another day. Next morning, I attended the usual prayers. I did not experience anything abnormal during the meditation period. Discussions generally take place when they assemble in the hall after breakfast. Maharshi also answers questions from earnest seekers. That morning, also, discussions were going on. As they were talking mostly in Tamil, a language not known to me, my attention was not attracted till I found some people turning their heads and laughing at me. On inquiry, I learned that they were discussing the subject matter in my first letter to the Maharshi. Evidently, he had spoken something to them regarding this letter. Though made a laughing stock, I was still glad to find out that he had at least taken notice of me. I took part in the discussion, and as I was in the back row, some distance away from them, they asked me to come near, so that there might not be any difficulty in following each other, and I obeyed. I was thus brought very near Maharshi's seat. Our discussions over, I heard Maharshi say, "He is concentrating on the reflection and complains that he cannot see the original." It struck me forcefully. What did he mean by reflection? And what was the original? I shut my eyes and tried to find out the meaning. Immediately after, I felt a pull in the region of the heart, similar to what I felt 2 days previously, but much stronger in intensity. My mind was completely arrested, still, but I was wide awake. Suddenly, without any break in my consciousness, the eye flashed forth. It was self-awareness, pure and simple, steady, unbroken, and intensely bright, as much brighter than ordinary consciousness as in sunlight, brighter than the dim light of a lamp. In ordinary consciousness, the I sense dimly remains in the background as a matter of inference or intuition, the whole of the consciousness being occupied by the object. Here, I came to the foreground, occupied, or rather became, the whole consciousness, and intensely existed as pure consciousness, dispelling all objects. I was, but I was neither the subject nor the object of this consciousness. I was this consciousness, which alone existed. There were no objects. The world was not, neither the body nor the mind, no thought, no motion. Time also ceased to exist. I alone existed, and that I was consciousness itself, self-luminous and alone, without a second. Suddenly, and again, without any break in my consciousness, I was brought back to my normal, ordinary consciousness. A great miracle had been performed in broad daylight, in the presence of so many people, without their knowing it. No argument of the greatest philosophers and scientists of the world will now make me doubt the possibility of experiencing the I in its pure state or pure consciousness without any subject-object relationship. Of course, I myself had not the least inkling of such a state, even a second later, and I never expected to get such an experience. I, an insignificant creature, wallowing in the mud of mundane existence without any sadhana, being granted this supreme experience, an experience which is rarely obtained even by great yogis after austerest spiritual practices strenuously performed for ages together. Such is the wonder of His grace, immeasurable and unfathomable grace. Truly, has it been said, unasked, Thou givest, this is thy imperishable fame. As soon as I was brought to my normal consciousness, I opened my eyes and looked at Maharshi. I knew from the heart of my heart that it was Maharshi who had very graciously granted me this experience. But he appeared to be quite unconcerned, as if nothing had happened. He was not even looking at me. How could he have performed this miracle? Was it by his silence? Is this then what is meant by mauna vakya prakritita parabrahma tatvam? Through silence is revealed the nature of parabrahman by the guru. Who can comprehend? The experience so much amazed me that I even forgot to express my heartfelt gratitude to Maharshi. I could not at that time even properly evaluate the supreme experience. I looked at my comrades. They did not seem to notice me, and so were ignorant of what had to happen. In like manner, unknown to others, to how many people has He graciously granted this and even higher experiences? He only knows. I looked at the clock. It was 20 minutes past 10. But as I did not look at the clock before the state supervened, I cannot say for how long I was in this wonderful state. A little later, we followed Maharshi to the dining hall and took our meal. The experience left a very cheerful mood in me. I felt completely carefree. The thought of home or of bombing did not trouble me any further. And I thought of staying in the ashram a few days more. But man only proposes. Just after the night meal was over, a certain gentleman came to me and said that he had already arranged a conveyance for me and a carriage was waiting for me at the gate to take me to the station. I was a little offended. Who asked him to bring the carriage? I had given up the idea of leaving the ashram today. But why should I blame him? He was present on the previous night when I asked for a carriage and saw my plight at not being able to start for home for the want of a carriage. In order that the same thing might not happen again, he very kindly taken upon himself the duty of helping me in arranging a carriage. How could he be aware of the change which had come over me? Moreover, he was only an instrument. I therefore said nothing to him. He took me to Maharshi, introduced me to him, and explained to him that I was leaving for home. I prostrated myself before the Maharshi, took leave of him, and started for the station. The previous day, I decided to go, but was compelled to stay. This day, I decided to stay, but was compelled to go. Mysterious are his ways.
Andhra, who lives in Chennai.
I don't think he lives in Chennai. He traveled through Chennai.
At that time, he traveled. Madras presidency.
He traveled through Chennai. He doesn't know Tamil, so I don't think he lives in
Chennai. Yeah, that's what
I'm
saying. He doesn't know Tamil.
It's probably Andhra Pradesh.
And he says his family in Chennai, he didn't even worry about them. So he lived in Chennai.
I don't think he said that, family in Chennai.
No, he's worried about the bombing and his family. So
yeah, but no, but he's the family's in Andhra Pradesh, near the coast, I'm thinking. Like
the east coast.
Lingeshwar now, Bhimavaram, in that area. Right. Yeah. And the, probably the,
it's
and
not
the coast
Balram,
of Andhra Pradesh.
Not Balram Reddy, right?
Yeah. No. He's not even married now.
Yeah, that's crossed off. He has a family.
Okay, I forgot. Right.